you know, consumers are getting a bunch of cheap food, but it's killing them. Farmers are scraping by on subsidies. If you're really big, you're not just scraping by. You're doing pretty well, but it's the government's basically footing the bill. The environment is taking a huge beating. Workers are taking a huge beating. And these companies, being smart, they take some of their profits and invest them in things like lobbying, campaign finance. And, you know, basically that goes into propping up the entire system, making it really hard. Like, you know, we've both been around for a while, Roger, watching farm bills. But basically the whole machinery of keeping this going has been maintained. And the reason why is because these companies are very adeptly basically owning the political system.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, people that listen to Farm to Table Talk are, I hear, listening because they're curious of what's going on in food and agriculture. And I am really happy to have someone with me today, Tom Philpott, who is doing this all the time. He's writing, does a podcast as well. And he has a book that's out that we're going to get him to talk about a little bit too. Tom Philpott, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me, Roger.
Tom, you have an interesting perspective. You started farming. You write about farming. You write about food. You write about politics related to agriculture. I'm curious, from all those perspectives and all the way that you're producing both, you know, your podcast and your book and so forth, are you finding a way to be relatively optimistic about the future of the food system in the United States?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the answer is yes, I guess I do climb into and focus on some, you know, a lot of the problems. I find myself being drawn to writing about the problems of industrial agriculture, the sort of festering, you know, crises, environmental, labor, just the, you know, incredible exploitation that the system is based on. And it is really, really depressing. But I also just see a lot of movement on the ground. I see a lot of inspiring thinking. I see a new generation. So, I've been writing about this stuff since 2004 or five. So that's about 15 years now. I'm feeling a little bit like a gnarled veteran. I came into this, I was 40 by the time I got into this topic. So I'm not a young person, but I'm seeing a lot of inspiring new thinking from young people. You know, stuff like Leah Penniman's project in upstate New York called Soulfire Farm. Are you familiar with that?
I am.
It's basically stuff like that that really inspires me. People thinking about, I think, two major problems with the foods, with sort of the farming and agriculture system. One of them is the race problem, the sort of systematic theft of farmland from Black people over the past century. And then Leah's also really trained her sights on this other problem of the aging farm base. You know, everyone knows that, you know, average age of farmers in the United States is, you know, pushing 60. So there's going to be this this land succession. This land, you know, land's going to be handed down. And how are we going to do that? Are we going to keep it? Are we going to sort of stay on the present course of, you know, ever fewer and ever bigger farms? Or are we going to find some creative ways to get young people onto land in a way that's viable, in a way that they're not just sort of crushed by debt? Or either you have to be sort of, you have to inherit land or, you know, rent land, which is a pretty precarious situation, or be crushed by debt. And Leah is exploring other ways, like we as a society don't have to go in that direction. And I just, you know, stuff like that, I find really inspiring that there are people on the ground with very fresh thinking, doing really interesting things.
You know, I think if you go back far enough, everybody's family were farmers. I often end up interviewing people that want to be farmers. And I said, you come from a farm background. They say, no, but I mean, really, you go back and at one point in time, maybe 1,000 years ago or so, everybody farmed. And even in the early years of this country, it was like 80% or something were.
Sure.
And then everybody else was producing for farms. But where some of us grew up, you know, like where I grew up in the farmland, everybody that farmed had come from Ireland or Germany. And then everybody in town that eventually worked for the coal mines came from Italy. And but there wasn't a lot of diversity. I mean, other than that, that was the mix of where, you know, the mix everybody was coming from. But the one thing I think that they can all relate to, even though there's not evenly distributed opportunities for diversity all over the country, it is pretty evenly distributed problems with aging, and that older farmers are getting older all the time. And young people, like you're saying, they're finding ways to get started. And it must be interesting for you, too, because at one stage you were farming, and then you decided to not farm and write about it. And you look back at all these people that are saying, I want to be Tom Philpott 15 years ago or 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's true. And there was actually a period when I was doing both. And I get tired when I think about it. And my story is, I think, fairly typical because I wouldn't have been able to farm in any meaningful way except for my significant other had family land and there a farm in her family that there was a transition and a new generation, you know, there was a decision to make about whether to keep it or whether to sell it. And if we, you know, if it was going to be kept, someone had to be there farming it. And we moved there to do that. So I farmed on family land. And yeah, it's, it was quite a lifestyle change from being a business writer in New York to suddenly being a farmer. And actually, my farming career started with a combination of writing and farming because when I left New York, I had a half-time gig writing a little newsletter for Reuters. And that gig, you know, that was our income when we launched. And I did that for, I think, a year or at least six months. And that was exhausting. And then there was a period of just farming. And then I transitioned into writing, you know, writing about food politics and farming. And that's when it got really exhausting. Just, you know, farming is essentially a series of deadlines. You got a farmer's market, you've got your chef's day, you've got your, you know, the days that you're harvesting, the days that you're marketing and calling up the chefs, CSA pickup. You know, these were weekly things for me. And then I had an editor on my back wondering where my column was. and so that was quite a period of exhaustion.
You know, Tom, when I missed that part of it, that you were doing writing before you went to the farm, and then you're doing all of this communicating now, reporting on what's going on out there. What seems to be the common motivation for people to look across the fence and saying, boy, I wish I could be a farmer?
Well, I mean, I guess I should just try to tell my story and then we can figure out if there's a bigger trend attached to it. But for me, you know, my family in recent memory weren't farmers. Like my, you know, dad's both sides are sort of Irish Catholic in the United States since at least the early 20th century. And Chicago people, you know, basically in the Irish Catholic daily machine of Chicago was sort of my family roots. And you know, growing up in Austin, Texas, my dad was a professor. Yeah, I grew up in the sort of, you know, like everyone else in this environment in the 70s of, you know, sort of Hamburger Helper and McDonald's and the explosion of convenience foods. But my mom was also someone who cooked and she would do these elaborate parties in the weekend. And not every weekend, but maybe once a month. And in that time, I, you know, came to appreciate that food didn't have to be this sort of brutalized. You know, I learned the difference. You know, basically, it was an eclair that my mom made when I was a kid. I was like, wow, this is delicate and interesting and subtle. And so I just carried that and was always very into politics, but really got into the aesthetics of food, like really just sort of digging into recipes and cooking, you know, became a passionate cook. And I started to ask questions about, I was learning about all this great food and cooking all this great food and, you know, working in restaurants and making friends with people who are into food. And just started asking the question, why is this in this country, this is the, we're the freaks and the norm is just sort of McDonald's and, you know, the supermarket and convenience foods. And, you know, starting to ask that question, just, you know, you inevitably turn to where does food come from? How is it grown? And then you want to get your hands in the dirt. So I had a little garden in Austin. Then I left Austin, ended up in New York City, had a, was involved in the community gardening in New York City. And that's sort of how the bug started, was this falling in love with food, wondering why, you know, why does Mexico just south of us have such a magnificent food culture? And why is, you know, our food system so focused on churning out massive, massive amounts of inexpensive food? And then, you know, just sort of tying it to labor and how, like, you know, basically the, you know, post 1975 US economy has been based on stagnant wages. And there's been this collapse in labor power based on the collapse of trade unions, things like that. And, you know, suddenly started to see this cheap food policy as underpinning this really unjust economic system. And, you know, just started asking questions about that. And then, you know, I also was, you know, in New York City in the community garden movement. It wasn't just this idyllic thing because Mayor Giuliani, who was then mayor and is now in the headlines for other machinations, one of the things that he was doing was trying to essentially pave over the community gardens and, you know, by handing them to his developer cronies. And that, you know, that kind of got me swept up into a big social movement around food justice that was happening in New York City in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so that's kind of how I got into it. So by the time this opportunity came to move to this farm, you know, I was already totally obsessed with growing food and figuring out, you know, what, you know, get, you know, sort of putting my body on the line by farming in the movement to challenge the sort of dominant food system.
Well, if you don't have that energy to take on and challenge a system, you and I would imagine you'd have this in common with other people that you must like to be able to do stuff outside. Being outdoors and then being your own boss, so to speak, seems to also be high on the list for people.
You know, definitely. And also just, I mean, I think that, you know, in our culture, the sort of professional class, we end up, you know, if you're, we get sort of put into these different classes. And if you're the professional class, you're behind a computer all day, which I am now behind a computer all day. But, you know, part of the real pleasure was being liberated from that. Like I'd be behind a computer part of the day, but to be out there in the field doing things, you know, laying hands on great food, getting my hands in the dirt, planting food. And also for us, you know, we were kind of a cooperative and it wasn't so much being my own boss. It was sort of being part of a collaborative project, working together to, you know, do these various projects that we're doing. That was also a big rush. On our farm, Maverick Farms, I was never my own boss. It was always very, very much of a collaborative.
Well, but at least,
you know, it was horizontal. Like now, I have a boss. I have an editor. I'm in a hierarchy at a magazine. But this was really, really horizontal, and that was great.
Well, there's kind of a leap here, because you might have collaboration with these other people, but if you had gone the industrial route and you got really, really large, you probably would have been locked into supplying just one really large company, and you would lose flexibility. And that's kind of a way to bridge into another area I know you paid attention to lately too, and that is the concentration effects, both of processing companies and distribution companies and those supplying farmers. You've looked at that recently.
Yeah.
Explain that. Could you set that up a little bit at to what extent maybe we should be worried, concerned, or on these issues of having a narrowing number of people, of bigger companies that we're dependent on, either to sell our food to distribute the food to, and what effect that has on us in our food system?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is an economy-wide phenomenon, but you know, basically, U.S. antitrust authorities in the Reagan era started to ask the question when they're looking at mergers, you know, how does this affect consumers? Does this harm consumers? Is this going to lead to market power that will translate into higher prices for consumers? And if the answer is no, then they would approve the merger. And before that, they also asked questions about what about suppliers? What about, you know, so if I let these two giant companies merge, will it harm the companies that or the, you know, entities that supplied them? And that question stopped being asked. And so what you got was this spasm throughout the economy of mergers, including in food. And from the government's perspective, it was a great deal because, you know, food is cheap in the United States. We, you know, depending on what number you use, something like 10% of income on the aggregate goes into food, maybe 12 or 13%. But, you know, that number does hide significant inequalities. I was just reading people who are, you know, over the poverty line, but close to the poverty, you know, within distance of the poverty line, pay as much as 30% of their income on food. So that the cheap food system doesn't work great, you know, isn't that cheap for everyone. What's happened is that it's in commodity farming and sort of the corn and soybean belt, it's led to a situation where you've got, you know, these three or four company oligopolies that are dealing with farmers at every step of the way, from fertilizer to seeds and pesticides, which have merged into one, you know, entity, to grain trading firms, to meat packing firms that buy the corn and soybeans and feed them to animals. Every step of the way, you've got these oligopolies. Some of them are the same company, like Cargill is a huge grain trader and a huge meat company. And so what happens is you get this situation where you've got these, you know, farmers churning out billions of dollars worth of corn and soybeans at essentially a loss. Essentially, they're not making in the market what they're making back their costs from the market. And, you know, obviously government policy is what fills that gap. But this incredibly low margin activity generates billions of dollars in profits up and down this chain. You know, you're seeing the pesticide firms like Bayer and Syngenta, and, you know, your meat giants like JBS and Tyson, basically sucking all the profit out of this. And the taxpayer gets a bill to keep the farmers afloat. And then there's all these external costs that just fall on society, like, you know, dirty water and giant algae blooms and polluted air. The whole question arises of, well, who does the system benefit? Like, who's making, like, you know, who are the beneficiaries of this? You know, I think it turns out to be not the public, because if you look at the food that's generated from that system of, you know, sort of cheap meat and, you know, high fructose corn syrup and other corn sweeteners and soybean oil and corn oil, well, these are all the foods, all the ingredients that go into the highly processed foods that are emerging as this real villain in terms of public health. You know, basically, there's a lot of really good research that basically shows that diets that are based on this this kind of processed food are causing, you know, not just obesity, but type 2 diabetes, heart disease. The list just goes on and on and on. So it's not, you know, consumers are getting a bunch of cheap food, but it's killing them. Farmers are scraping by on subsidies and getting really, and if you're really big, you're not just scraping by, you're doing pretty well, but it's the government's basically footing the bill. The environment is taking a huge beating. Workers are taking a huge beating. And these companies being smart, they take some of their profits and invest them in things like lobbying, campaign finance. And, you know, basically that goes into propping up the entire system and keeping it, making it really hard. Like, you know, we've both been around for a while, Roger, watching farm bills, and farm bills have, you know, there's been some tweaks to policy, a move to, you know, subsidized crop insurance, taking some of the place of direct payments. But basically the whole machinery of keeping this going has been maintained. And the reason why is because these, you know, these companies are very adeptly, you know, basically owning the political system. And so I think that's really, in the end, the big problem with this is that it generates such outside profits for a few companies that they end up translating that into political power in a way that is damaging for everyone but for their shareholders.
Well, and the reason that we created antitrust laws was that there was a fear that if you could create a monopoly, that monopoly could assert pressure both on the suppliers that produce for them that have no place else to go with their product, and also with an end consumer that they can, that they've got that kind of power. So they're in a strong position. You add the political power of all the money you're talking about, and it's serious. It's going to be interesting to see if, Tom, in the next few years, whether or not antitrust starts looking at these more and asking the questions and saying, well, how much concentration are we going to allow? I assume the food issues are going to have to get in line behind Google and some of the others that are, that are getting looked at, hopefully.
And you do see on the Biden agency transition teams, there are, I have this in a recent article, maybe even the one you're talking about, I can't remember. But they, you know, there are people in those transition processes, at least, that who are very strong on antitrust. And so that, you know, that just shows me that that issue does have its ear on some level. So we'll see how that goes and how that translates into the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission.
As we speak, there's a lot of debate on what the leadership will look like at the Department of Agriculture. There's been talk about other secretaries and in the Biden administration. And one of the things that's taking shape is that on the one hand, there's a case to get somebody that could lead the department that has the perspective more of the consumers that is from an urban area. And on the other hand, it's, well, how are you going to get the farmers kind of back in support of the new administration unless you have somebody that's coming from a farm state and more of a farmer perspective? So sometime before we're through listening to these podcasts, that'll get worked out. But it's a, it's an interesting dimension right now. That, and I don't, I always feel like it doesn't have to be either or. I mean, hopefully we're going to be doing some balance, but that debate's coming to the forefront right now.
Yeah, it is. And it looks like we have a short list. It's really hard to say. I mean, everyone I talk to who's, you might think might be privy to some of those discussions say that it's completely black box. They're, you know, very tight lipped about it. But, you know, there have been indications that it's a race between Tom Vilsack and or Heidi Heitkamp, who is a former senator from North Dakota. And Marsha Fudge, who I think you were referring to earlier, who's a representative from Ohio, from Cleveland. You know, her district is in the Cleveland area. And yeah, it'll be interesting. And I just wish that... that there was someone, because, you know, basically Heitkamp and Vilsack represent a kind of business as usual approach in their ag policy. Obama, Vilsack was obviously in there under Obama and, didn't do anything to challenge any of this in the end. He made some noises about it, but, basically propped up the policy. And I just wonder if there is, and this is an open question, I honestly don't know the answer to it, but if there is a kind of rural populist potential, someone who could speak to rural voters, who's from rural America, but doesn't represent this sort of old agribusiness as usual kind of thinking. And, someone who comes to mind who you see on shortlists every once in a while, and that is John Boyd. He is a Virginia farmer, and he's an African-American farmer. And I know that he's been involved with the Organization for Competitive Markets, which is kind of a rural populist sort of breakup agribusiness kind of group. And so, I wonder if someone like him, but, it's a very tough one because there's, it's also a big, giant, sprawling federal agency. And, you have to balance experience running a big agency versus new thinking. And so I just, something else I feel from doing some reporting on this is that the bench of people involved is, there's not a very deep bench. I think Marsha Fudge is a great candidate, but I wish there were more great candidates. Recycling Vilsack, going into Heidi Heitkamp, a one-term senator without a lot of, she's more into the fossil fuel interests of North Dakota than she is the farm interests. So I just feel like there's a shallow bench problem in the Democratic Party when it comes to rural policy now.
I've heard Karen Ross's name mentioned. She's our Secretary of Agriculture here in California.
I've heard her name mentioned too.
And she was back as the Chief of Staff for Vilsack for a while before she came back here to be our Secretary of Agriculture. It's a really, really important time. And I think that a lot of the conversations right now are saying, well, gee, there's 75% of the farmers are red state or totally committed. And yet, when I grew up, you couldn't find a farmer that wasn't a Democrat and in central Illinois. And, they were all Democrats and you didn't know any Republicans. All the Republicans lived in the town or in the city.
Yeah.
But all the rural were Democrats. And even in the last election with Obama, I know so many Republicans across the country, the Republican farmers, have voted for Obama. And they were happy to see him coming in and so forth. But I think that one thing that everybody has in common right now, whether or not they identify with being red or blue, is frustration. And I think you caught some of that across the country. Whether or not they end up voting Republican or Democrat or supporting this candidate or that candidate, there's a lot of people that aren't happy with the circumstances in rural America. And I think part of what fascinates me about your getting to do a book, Tom, is you really plunged in. You got out there and you got around the country. I'm envious. We can all read your book and try to get it from that standpoint, but I'm a little envious of you getting to do that kind of traveling, especially we're in a year where we're not doing any traveling at all.
I know.
But what was that like getting, you spent a lot of time in the Midwest and also out here in California, two different types of agriculture with very different kind of circumstances. What did you find when you were out there?
Yeah, I mean, I found in the San Joaquin Valley of California, there is this thing that I'm certainly not the first person to observe this, but I just find it really heartbreaking that in the places where this sort of large scale industrial agriculture really takes hold, they end up being some of the most depressed places that you can find in terms of water quality, air quality, wages. And so I did observe hanging out in the San Joaquin Valley and actually also in Iowa, was in both places for more than a month in researching the book. And I did observe a lot of really depressing living conditions and hear a lot of really bad stories about what it's like to live in those places. And that, you know, that experience weighed heavily on me. And, but I also should say that I found in both those places this incredible spirit of people organizing and fighting back. And that was particularly strong in the San Joaquin Valley, where I saw incredible social movement activity around things like, you know, fighting for clean water, that, you know, farm workers making, you know, basically the minimum wage of California, which is higher than the national minimum wage, but, you know, living in near or at the poverty line, having to buy bottled water, and just how, you know, they're paying a bill, they're paying a water bill, but they're having to buy bottled water because the water they drink is polluted. I just saw a lot of great social movement organizing, and a lot of it was the kids of farm workers who were able, because of California has, and less so now, but at, you know, when they were kids, let's say in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, they, you know, excellent university system. So these farm worker kids, some of them were able to go to places like Berkeley or Fresno State and get great educations and come back and become really fantastic activists. And I witnessed that multiple times in the San Joaquin Valley, and I found that very inspiring, that people loved, I mean, these are really great and special places, both San Joaquin Valley and the Corn Belt. They're incredible, they're incredibly ecologically interesting places that are in the process of being ruined, but some of the people living there really, really care and are fighting back. And I found that incredibly inspiring. And similar in Iowa, of just, you know, younger activists, many of them sons and daughters of corn and soybean farmers and hog farmers, fighting for clean water and a fairer system of agriculture. So it was both depressing and also incredibly inspiring to be in those places.
You know, I can get it when you say that. And I know, too, in the Central Valley of California, there's can't even begin to count all the people that I've met. Parents came over to harvest fruits and vegetables, and they were able to go to Fresno State or Cal Poly or somewhere and come back, get hired in a larger farm operation and running a division. And those changes are taking place. So you're seeing some new faces and some younger faces, and you're seeing some diversity. When you look at the Corn Belt, I think you've talked about before about all the erosion that's, you know, that takes place. But one thing, I think one of the bright spots to point out is that now, because of no-till, they're doing so much better. If you look at the amount of corn and soybean land that is basically they're not tilling, I wonder if they're getting enough credit for that progress.
I would encourage you to read, I think it's chapter six of my book, because one thing that's happening in Iowa is that basically because the corn and soybeans are all, because we're down to two crops, corn and soybeans, right? I mean, there used to be more crops in rotation, and we could talk about why it narrowed down, you know, wheat and oats got taken out and now it's corn and soybeans, and why, you know, you used to have a lot more cows and hogs outside on land, and, you know, those have been pushed indoors, in the case of cows, pushed indoors as soon as possible. And so you're taking animals off the land and you're taking crops off the land, except for corn and soybeans. So you're down to corn and soybeans. So now you got two crops that are planted and harvested at the same time. And there's this thing that happens in the spring that creates a bunch of erosion that doesn't always get counted. And that is, you get these huge storms. I happen to be for the book, I happen to be able to visit in 2019 during a really, one of the wettest springs in the region's history. And what happens is, because there's very little cover, maybe you get some stubble because of no-till, but there's no living roots in the land, and there's no canopy over the ground. And so you get these powerful storms that come through, And it just pummels the soil and sends it on the move. And there's this great professor who is in the, had in the book, his name is Richard Cruz out of Iowa State University. And what he basically, he's a soil agronomist. And what he basically finds is if you look at the EPA, the USDA number, it's that Iowa loses about I think he says the number for Iowa was about 5.8 tons of topsoil per acre per year in erosion. It loses that much, but it regains through natural regeneration about 5 tons per year. And so you get, you know, it's almost a one-to-one balance. They're losing some soil net, but it's not a dire situation. And what Rick Cruz shows is that the USDA is only counting one kind of erosion. That's called sheet and rill erosion. And I know we're getting into the weeds, but this is a farm show. But there's this other kind of erosion that happens. It's called gully erosion. And that's when you get in the contours of land, you get these gashes that form carrying water from a high place to a lower place. And with these gashes, you get the loss of multiple tons of topsoil. And, you know, during a really bad year like 2019, it's catastrophic amounts. And Rick says that if you average it out, it's about 3 tons of topsoil additional per year. And so now you're at you're at more than 8 tons of topsoil lost. And then Rick also says that the sustainable, you know, the sort of amount that's regenerated, he says the USDA is using this 5 tons figure and it's not based on much of anything at all. And that the best research suggests that it's more like a half a ton of per acre per year. And so when you do the math on that, now you're losing topsoil. Instead of almost 1-to-1, it's more like 16-to-1. And so you've got a pretty good soil crisis that has not been reversed by the rise of no-till in the Midwest. And so that's kind of where we are. And it's not just, you know, it's not a conspiracy that USDA doesn't count gully erosion. USDA acknowledges gully erosion, but the technology for predicting it, mapping it, measuring it is not there yet. And so it's just not in the numbers. But it's real. Like I did an article about it in 2019 on Mother Jones. It's got some pictures, but I also described it in my book. And it is visible to the eye. Like you go there during a wet spring and you'll see it. And the problem is that climate change is making it way worse because the frequency and intensity of spring storms has risen dramatically to where like your childhood in Iowa is in Illinois, central Illinois, it's a different world now. It's significantly more of these events. And so, you know, right now, I think the Midwest desperately needs to figure out a way to cover much more of its ground in the winter months, whether it's, you know, adding crops like winter rye, which comes up in my book, or cover crops or whatever it is, something's got to give there.
That's a really, really good point. And then it's an example of how we need to have more conversations about these things. Because, you know, I mean, I grew up knowing that there was conservation agencies and we had conservation programs and committees in every county and people trying to do the right thing and putting in knowing how you had to, when you plowed, how you did it and put waterways and dams and all those things. But I think what you're pointing out is there's more to know and there's more improvements to be made. And the thing I find myself thinking about, Tom, as you were describing that, is that we can use more research. We can use more work by the land-grant universities. We can use more support of the extension services. And those are all not getting funded to the levels that they need. USDA used to have billions of dollars that were going out for research, and they were running research laboratories on some of the basic things that they weren't depending on companies to be able to fund all the research. They were looking at things like this, and they're doing less of it.
That's right. That is very, very true. And I think, you know, something like the NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service, should get a lot more funding. I think it's absolutely crucial. And, you know, it obviously came up out of the Dust Bowl, but I think there are people on NRCS that know this stuff and are pushing really hard to get farmers to do stuff, diversify their crops and plant cover crops. But the economic forces that farmers are under that we talked about earlier push them in the other direction. There's just not incentive in the marketplace for it.
Where you sit behind your computer now, instead of out in a field getting your hands dirty, but you're behind a computer right now and you're looking at agriculture, where do you see it heading? I mean, where are you interested in covering if you're going to continue to share these stories about what's happening in food and agriculture and trends? What are you interested in pursuing in this coming year?
I'm really interested in the land ownership questions that I was discussing before, the land transition, the ways to get new farmers not only just onto the land, but into an economic model that is not as brutally destructive as the current one. And, you know, that sort of loops back to the question about, you know, what am I optimistic about?
Yeah.
It's really the same thing. I'm really interested in the projects that are going on the ground. And I've written about a couple of them recently, and I want to pursue this more about young folks rethinking the system. I mean, I feel like when I went in, I was part of a little boom in people going back to the land or going to the land, not back to the land, going to the land and starting to farm and basically accepting, you know, okay, we're going to go to the farmer's market. The CSA is a great model and it is an alternative model that a lot of people, including our farm, accepted. And I think we've seen the limits of those things. And I think we're seeing now young folks rethinking how to make it work. And that's definitely a story that I want to cover going forward. You know, I'm also going to be covering inevitably just the politics, you know, how the USDA plays out. You know, the Farm Bill won't get voted on until 2023, I think, but we could see it start to be debated.
I hope in all these things, Tom, you know, it doesn't end up seeming too much like an either or, that it's a both and. The one thing I've always felt good about working with Department of Agriculture for years, whether it was Republican or whether it was Democrat, there was something about the Department of Agriculture that knew they were working for and with farmers, not exclusively. I think they knew the other responsibility too, but in many respects, that's one place you could walk in Washington, D.C., you really weren't that aware of which party the agency was from because they were a little bit more grounded, literally, in what's good for farmers. But farmers and consumers, hopefully that's what we'll see as this new team takes the field.
Yeah, totally agreed with that.
And I think a lot of good news, too. I'm like you. You see some things to be optimistic about. I see reasons to be optimistic in large scale and small scale and organic and conventional. I see people trying to head the right direction. And hopefully we can have conversations like this and the work you do to keep encouraging them to go that direction. And so if people looking for more of that encouragement from you, why don't you remind them where they can read your book or see your articles or hear your podcast?
Yes, if you look up Google my name, Tom Philpott, and Mother Jones. So you'll find my article page at Mother Jones, and then I'm on Twitter at Tom Philpott. And my book is Perilous Bounty, and you can find that at any place you get your books. I like bookshop.org, which is a way to mail order books without getting involved with Amazon. But, you know, get it any way you can. I am part of a podcast that is called The Secret Ingredient, which you can find on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you get your podcasts, and that is with Raj Patel and Rebecca McEnroy of KUT radio station in Austin, Texas, but it's, you know, on all the podcast apps. I'm also part of Bite Podcast with Mother Jones, which is currently on hiatus, but it will be back in the new year doing series of episodes, not just one-off episodes. So look for Bite on Apple Podcasts as well. And both of those podcasts, Mother Jones and Secret Ingredient and Bite, have big backlogs on the Apple Podcast app. And so check those out as well.
Well, Tom, I always enjoy your stories and I've enjoyed this conversation too, and learned a lot from what you've been able to discover. And I just want to thank you for taking the time to be with me on Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me, Roger.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.